Uncle Peter whipped up the horse. "You young misses ought to take shame getting Miss Pitty in a state," he scolded.
"I'm not in a state," replied Pitty, surprisingly, for less strain than this had frequently brought on fainting fits. "Millie, honey, I knew you were doing it just to take up for me, and really, I was glad to see somebody take Dolly down a peg. She's so bossy. How did you have the courage? But do you think you should have said that about Ashley?"
"But it's true," answered Melanie, and she began to cry softly. "And I'm not ashamed that he thinks that way. He thinks the war is all wrong, but he's willing to fight and die anyway. And that takes lots more courage than fighting for something you think is right." "Lord, Miss Melly, don't cry here on Peachtree Street," groaned Uncle Peter, hastening his horse's pace. "Folks'll talk something scandalous. Wait till us gets home."
Scarlet said nothing. She did not even squeeze the hand that Melanie had inserted into her palm for comfort. She had read Ashley's letters for only one purpose, to assure herself that he still loved her. Now Melanie had given a new meaning to passages in the letters which Scarlet's eyes had barely seen. It shocked her to realize that anyone as absolutely perfect as Ashley could have any thought in common with such a reprobate as Rhett Butler. She thought, "They both see the truth of this war, but Ashley is willing to die about it and Rhett isn't. I think that shows Rhett's good sense." She paused a moment, horror-struck that she could have such a thought about Ashley. "They both see the same unpleasant truth. But Rhett likes to look it in the face and enrage people by talking about it. And Ashley can hardly bear to face it." It was very bewildering. Chapter 13. Under Mrs. Merriweather's goading, Dr. Meade took action, in the form of a letter to the newspaper wherein he did not mention Rhett by name, though his meaning was obvious. The editor, sensing the social drama of the letter, put it on the second page of the paper, in itself a startling innovation. As the first two pages of the paper were always devoted to advertisements of slaves, mules, plows, coffins, houses for sale or rent, cures for private diseases, abortifacients and restoratives for lost manhood. The doctor's letter was the first of a chorus of indignation that was beginning to be heard all over the South against speculators, profiteers, and holders of government contracts. Conditions in Wilmington, the chief blockade port, now that Charleston's port was practically sealed by the Yankee gunboats, had reached the proportions of an open scandal. Speculators swarmed Wilmington, and having the ready cash, bought up boatloads of goods and held them for a rise in prices. The rise always came, for with the increasing scarcity of necessities, prices leaped higher by the month. The civilian population had either to do without or buy at the speculators' prices, and the poor and those in moderate circumstances were suffering increasing hardships. With the rise in prices, Confederate money sank, and with its rapid fall, there rose a wild passion for luxuries. Blockaders were commissioned to bring in necessities and were permitted to trade in luxuries only as a sideline, but now it was the higher-priced luxuries that filled their boats to the exclusion of the things the Confederacy vitally needed. People frenziedly bought these luxuries with the money they had today, fearing that tomorrow's prices would be higher and the money worth less. To make matters worse, there was only one railroad line from Wilmington to Richmond, and while thousands of barrels of flour and boxes of bacon spoiled and rotted in wayside stations for want of transportation,
Speculators with wines, taffetas, and coffee to sell seemed always able to get their goods to Richmond 2 days after they were landed at Wilmington. The rumor which had been creeping about underground was now being openly discussed. That Rhett Butler not only ran his own 4 boats and sold the cargoes at unheard-of prices, but bought up the cargoes of other boats and held them for rises in prices. It was said that he was at the head of a combine worth more than $1 million, with Wilmington as its headquarters for the purpose of buying blockade goods on the docks. There are dozens of warehouses in that city and in Richmond, so the story ran. And the warehouses were crammed with food and clothing that were being held for higher prices. Already soldiers and civilians alike were feeling the pinch, and the muttering against him and his fellow speculators was bitter. "There are many brave and patriotic men in the blockade arm of the Confederacy's naval service," ran the last of the doctor's letter. "Unselfish men who are risking their lives and all their wealth that the Confederacy may survive. They are enshrined in the hearts of all loyal Southerners, and no one begrudges them the scant monetary returns they make for their risks. They are unselfish gentlemen, and we honor them. Of these men, I do not speak. But there are others, scoundrels, who masquerade under the cloak of the blockader for their own selfish gains, and I call down the just wrath and vengeance of an embattled people, fighting in the justice of causes. On these human vultures who bring in satins and laces when our men are dying for want of quinine, who load their boats with tea and wines when our heroes are writhing for lack of morphia. I execrate these vampires who are sucking the lifeblood of the men who follow Robert Lee. These men who are making the very name of blockader a stench in the nostrils of all patriotic men. How could we endure these scavengers in our midst with their varnished boots when our boys are tramping barefoot into battle? How can we tolerate them with their champagnes and their pâtés of Strasbourg when our soldiers are shivering about their campfires and gnawing moldy bacon? I call upon every loyal Confederate to cast them out." Atlanta Red knew the oracle had spoken, and as loyal Confederates, they hastened to cast Rhett out. Of all the homes which had received him in the fall of 1862, Miss Pittypat's was almost the only one into which he could enter in 1863. And except for Melanie, he probably would not have been received there. Aunt Pitty was in a state whenever he was in town. She knew very well what her friends were saying when she permitted him to call, but she still lacked the courage to tell him he was unwelcome. Each time he arrived in Atlanta, she set her fat mouth and told the girls that she would meet him at the door and forbid him to enter. And each time he came, a little package in his hand and a compliment for her charm and beauty on his lips. She wilted. "I just don't know what to do," she would moan. "He just looks at me, and I'm scared to death of what he would do if I told him. He's got such a bad reputation. Do you suppose he would strike me, or... Oh, dear, if Charlie were only alive. Scarlett, you must tell him not to call again. Tell him in a nice way. Oh, me! I do believe you encourage him, and the whole town is talking, and if your mother ever finds out, what will she say to me?" "Melly, you must not be so nice to him. Be cool and distant, and he will understand." "Oh, Melly, do you think I'd better write Henry a note and ask him to speak to Captain Butler?"
"No, I don't," said Melanie. "And I won't be rude to him either. I think people are acting like chickens with their heads off about Captain Butler. I'm sure he can't be all the bad things Dr. Meade and Mrs. Merriweather say he is. He wouldn't hold food from starving people. Why, he even gave me $100 for the orphans. I'm sure he's just as loyal and patriotic as any of us, and he's just too proud to defend himself. You know how obstinate men are when they get their backs up." Aunt Pitty knew nothing about men, either with their backs up or otherwise, and she could only wave her fat little hands helplessly. As for Scarlett,
She had long ago become resigned to Melanie's habit of seeing good in everyone. Melanie was a fool, but there was nothing anybody could do about it.
Scarlett knew that Rhett was not being patriotic, and though she would have died rather than confess it,
she didn't care. The little presents he brought her from Nassau, little oddments that a lady could accept with propriety, were what mattered most to her. With prices as high as they were, where on earth could she get needles and bonbons and hairpins if she forbade the house to him? No, it was easier to shift the responsibility to Aunt Pity, who, after all, was the head of the house, the chaperone, and the arbiter of morals. Scarlett knew the town gossiped about Rhett's calls, and about her, too. But she also knew that in the eyes of Atlanta, Melanie Wilkes could do no wrong. And if Melanie defended Rhett, his calls were still tinged with respectability. However, life would be pleasanter if Rhett would recant his heresies. She wouldn't have to suffer the embarrassment of seeing him cut openly when she walked down Peachtree Street with him. "Even if you think such things, why do you say them?" she scolded. "If you just think what you please but keep your mouth shut, everything would be so much nicer."
"That's your system, isn't it, my green-eyed hypocrite? Scarlet, Scarlet, I hoped for more courageous conduct from you. I thought the Irish said what they thought, and the divil take the hindermost. Tell me truthfully, don't you sometimes almost burst from keeping your mouth shut?"
"Well, yes," Scarlett confessed reluctantly. "I do get awfully bored when they talk about the cause morning, noon, and night. But goodness, Rhett Butler, if I admitted it, nobody would speak to me, and none of the boys would dance with me."
"Ah, yes. And one must be danced with at all costs. Well, I admire your self-control, but I do not find myself equal to it. Nor can I masquerade in a cloak of romance and patriotism, no matter how convenient it might be. There are enough stupid patriots who are risking every cent they have in the blockade, and who are going to come out of this war paupers. They don't need me among their number, either to brighten the record of patriotism or to increase the role of paupers. Let them have the halos. They deserve them. For once, I am being sincere. And besides, halos will be about all they will have in a year or so."
"I think you are very nasty to even hint such things when you know very well that England and France are coming in on our side in no time, and—"
"Why, Scarlett, you must have been reading a newspaper. I'm surprised at you. Don't do it again. It addles women's brains. For your information, I was in England not a month ago, and I'll tell you this. England will never help the Confederacy. England never bets on the underdog. That's why she's England. Besides, the fat Dutch woman who is sitting on the throne is a God-fearing soul, and she doesn't approve of slavery. Let the English mill workers starve because they can't get our cotton, but never, never strike a blow for slavery. And as for France, that weak imitation of Napoleon is far too busy establishing the French in Mexico to be bothered with us. In fact, he welcomes this war because it keeps us too busy to run his troops out of Mexico. No, Scarlett, the idea of assistance from abroad is just a newspaper invention to keep up the morale of the South. The Confederacy is doomed. It's living on its hump now, like the camel. And even the largest of humps aren't inexhaustible. I give myself about 6 months more blockading, and then I'm through. After that, it'll be too risky. And I'll sell my boats to some foolish Englishman who thinks he can slip them through. But one way or another, it's not bothering me. I've made money enough, and it's in English banks and in gold. None of this worthless paper for me."
As always, when he spoke, he sounded so plausible.
Other people might call his utterances treachery, but to Scarlet they always rang with common sense and truth. And she knew that this was utterly wrong, knew she should be shocked and infuriated. Actually, she was neither, but she could pretend to be. It made her feel more respectable and ladylike. "I think what Dr. Meade wrote about you was right, Captain Butler. The only way to redeem yourself is to enlist after you sell your boats. You're a West Pointer, and..."
"You talk like a Baptist preacher making a recruiting speech. Suppose I don't want to redeem myself. Why should I fight to uphold the system that cast me out? I shall take pleasure in seeing it smashed."
"I never heard of any system," she said crossly.
"No. And yet you are part of it, like I was. And I'll wager you don't like it any more than I did. Well, why am I the black sheep of the Butler family? For this reason and no other, I didn't conform to Charleston, and I couldn't. And Charleston is the South, only intensified. I wonder if you realize yet what a bore it is. So many things that one must do because they've always been done. So many things quite harmless that one must not do for the same reason. So many things that annoyed me by their senselessness. Not marrying the young lady of whom, you have probably heard, was merely the last straw. Why should I marry a boring fool simply because an accident prevented me from getting her home before dark? And why permit her wild-eyed brother to shoot and kill me when I could shoot straighter? If I had been a gentleman, of course, I would have let him kill me, and that would have wiped the blot from the Butler escutcheon. But I like to live. And so I've lived, and I've had a good time. When I think of my brother living among the sacred cows of Charleston, and most reverent toward them, and remember his stodgy wife and his Saint Cecilia balls and his everlasting rice fields, then I know the compensation for breaking with the system. Scarlet, our southern way of living is as antiquated as the feudal system of the Middle Ages. The wonder is that it's lasted as long as it has. It had to go, and it's going now. And yet you expect me to listen to orators like Dr. Meade who tell me our cause is just and holy? And get so excited by the roll of drums that I'll grab a musket and rush off to Virginia to shed my blood for Marse Robert? What kind of a fool do you think I am? Kissing the rod that chastised me is not in my line. The South and I are even now. The South threw me out to starve once. I haven't starved. And I'm making enough money out of the South's death throes to compensate me for my lost birthright. I think you are vile and mercenary, said Scarlet. But her remark was automatic. Most of what he was saying went over her head, as did any conversation that was not personal. But part of it made sense. There were such a lot of foolish things about life among nice people. Having to pretend that her heart was in the grave when it wasn't. And how shocked everybody had been when she danced at the bazaar. And the infuriating way people lifted their eyebrows every time she did or said anything the least bit different from what every other young woman did and said. But still, she was jarred at hearing him attack the very traditions that irked her most. She had lived too long among people who dissembled politely, not to feel disturbed at hearing her own thoughts put into words. Mercenary?
No, I'm only far-sighted. Though perhaps that is merely a synonym for mercenary. At least, people who are not as far-sighted as I will call it that. Any loyal Confederate who had $1,000 in cash in 1861 could have done what I did, but how few were mercenary enough to take advantage of their opportunities? As for instance, right after Fort Sumter fell and before the blockade was established, I bought up several thousand bales of cotton at dirt-cheap prices and ran them to England. They are still there in warehouses in Liverpool. I've never sold them.
I'm holding them until the English mills have to have cotton and will give me any price I ask.
I wouldn't be surprised if I got a dollar a pound.
You get a dollar a pound when elephants roost in trees.
I believe I'll get it.
Cotton is at 72 cents a pound already. I'm going to be a rich man when the war is over, Scarlet, because I was far-sighted. Pardon me. Mercenary. I told you once before that there were two times for making big money, one in the upbuilding of a country and the other in its destruction. Slow money on the upbuilding, fast money in the crack-up. Remember my words. Perhaps they may be of use to you some day.
I do appreciate good advice so much, said Scarlet, with all the sarcasm she could muster. But I don't need your advice. Do you think Pa is a pauper? He's got all the money I'll ever need, and then I have Charles's property besides.
I imagine the French aristocrats thought practically the same thing, until the very moment when they climbed into the tumbrils.
Frequently, Rhett pointed out to Scarlet the inconsistency of her wearing black mourning clothes when she was participating in all social activities. He liked bright colors, and Scarlet's funeral dresses and the crepe veil that hung from her bonnet to her heels both amused him and offended him. But she clung to her dull black dresses and her veil, knowing that if she changed them for colors without waiting several more years, the town would buzz even more than it was already buzzing. And besides, how would she ever explain to her mother? Rhett said frankly that the crepe veil made her look like a crow, and the black dresses added 10 years to her age. This ungallant statement sent her flying to the mirror to see if she really did look 28 instead of 18.
"I should think you'd have more pride than to try to look like Mrs. Merriweather," he taunted. "And better taste than to wear that veil to advertise a grief I'm sure you never felt. I'll lay a wager with you. I'll have that bonnet and veil off your head and a Paris creation on it within 2 months."
"Indeed, no, and don't let's discuss it any further," said Scarlet, annoyed by his reference to Charles.
Rhett, who was preparing to leave for Wilmington for another trip abroad, departed with a grin on his face.
One bright summer morning, some weeks later, he reappeared with a brightly trimmed hat box in his hand, and after finding that Scarlet was alone in the house, he opened it. Wrapped in layers of tissue was a bonnet, a creation that made her cry, "Oh, the darling thing!" as she reached for it. Starved for the sight, much less the touch, of new clothes, it seemed the loveliest bonnet she had ever seen. It was of dark green taffeta, lined with watered silk of pale jade color. The ribbons that tied under the chin were as wide as her hand, and they, too, were pale green. And curled about the brim of this confection was the perkiest of green ostrich plumes.
"Put it on," said Rhett, smiling.
She flew across the room to the mirror and popped it on her head, pushing back her hair to show her earrings and tying the ribbon under her chin. "How do I look?" she cried, pirouetting for his benefit and tossing her head so that the plume danced. But she knew she looked pretty even before she saw confirmation in his eyes. She looked attractively saucy, and the green of the lining made her eyes dark emerald and sparkling.
"Oh, Rhett, whose bonnet is it? I'll buy it. I'll give you every cent I've got for it."
"It's your bonnet," he said. "Who else could wear that shade of green? Don't you think I carry the color of your eyes well in my mind?"
"Did you really have it trimmed just for me?"
"Yes. And there's Rue de la Paix on the box, if that means anything to you."
It meant nothing to her, smiling at her reflection in the mirror. Just at this moment, nothing mattered to her except that she looked utterly charming in the first pretty hat she had put on her head in 2 years. What she couldn't do with this hat. And then her smile faded. Don't you like it?
Oh, it's a dream, but... Oh, I do hate to have to cover this lovely green with crepe and dye the feather black.
He was beside her quickly, and his deft fingers untied the wide bow under her chin. In a moment the hat was back in its box.
What are you doing? You said it was mine.
But not to change to a mourning bonnet. I shall find some other charming lady with green eyes who appreciates my taste.
Oh, you shan't. I'll die if I don't have it. Oh, please, Rhett, don't be mean. Let me have it.
And turn it into a frat like your other hats? No. She clutched at the box. That sweet thing that made her look so young and enchanting to be given to some other girl? Oh, never. For a moment she thought of the horror of Pity and Melanie. She thought of Ellen and what she would say, and she shivered. But vanity was stronger.
I won't change it. I promise. Now do let me have it.
He gave her the box with a slightly sardonic smile, and watched her while she put it on again and preened herself.
How much is it? She asked suddenly, her face falling. I have only $50, but next month...
It will cost about $2,000 Confederate money. He said with a grin at her woebegone expression.
Oh, dear. Well, suppose I give you the 50 now, and then when I get...
I don't want any money for it, he said. It's a gift. Scarlett's mouth dropped open. The line was so closely, so carefully drawn where gifts from men were concerned. Candy and flowers, dear, Ellen had said time and again. And perhaps a book of poetry, or an album, or a small bottle of Florida water are the only things a lady may accept from a gentleman. Never, never any expensive gift, even from your fiancé. And never any gift of jewelry or wearing apparel, not even gloves or handkerchiefs. Should you accept such gifts, men would know you were no lady, and would try to take liberties. Oh, dear, thought Scarlett, looking first at herself in the mirror and then at Rhett's unreadable face.
I simply can't tell him I won't accept it. It's too darling. I'd almost rather he took a liberty, if it was a very small one.
Then she was horrified at herself for having such a thought, and she turned pink.
I'll give you the $50.
If you do, I will throw it in the gutter. Or better still, buy masses for your soul. I'm sure your soul could do with a few masses. She laughed, unwillingly. And the laughing reflection under the green brim decided her instantly.
Whatever are you trying to do to me?
I'm tempting you with fine gifts until your girlish ideals are quite worn away and you are at my mercy, he said. Accept only candy and flowers from gentlemen, dearie. He mimicked, and she burst into a giggle.
You are a clever, black-hearted wretch, Rhett Butler, and you know very well this bonnet's too pretty to be refused.
His eyes mocked her, even while they complimented her beauty. Of course, you can tell Miss Pity that you gave me a sample of taffeta and green silk and drew a picture of the bonnet and I extorted $50 from you for it.
No. I shall say $100, and she'll tell everybody in town, and everybody will be green with envy and talk about my extravagance. But, Rhett, you mustn't bring me anything else so expensive. It's awfully kind of you, but I really couldn't accept anything else.
Indeed? Well, I shall bring you presents so long as it pleases me, and so long as I see things that will enhance your charms. I shall bring you dark green watered silk for a frock to match the bonnet. And I warn you that I am not kind. I am tempting you with bonnets and bangles and leading you into a pit. Always remember, I never do anything without reason.
And I never give anything without expecting something in return. I always get paid.
His black eyes sought her face and traveled to her lips. Scarlet cast down her eyes, excitement filling her. Now, he was going to try to take liberties, just as Ellen predicted. He was going to kiss her, or try to kiss her. And she couldn't quite make up her flurried mind which it should be. If she refused, he might jerk the bonnet right off her head and give it to some other girl. On the other hand, if she permitted one chaste peck, he might bring her other lovely presents in the hope of getting another kiss. Men set such a store by kisses, though heaven alone knew why. And lots of times, after one kiss, they fell completely in love with a girl and made most entertaining spectacles of themselves, provided the girl was clever and withheld her kisses after the first one. It would be so exciting to have Rhett Butler in love with her and admitting it, and begging for a kiss or a smile. Yes, she would let him kiss her. But he made no move to kiss her. She gave him a sidelong glance from under her lashes and murmured encouragingly, "So you always get paid, do you? And what do you expect to get from me?"
"That remains to be seen."
"Well, if you think I'll marry you to pay for the bonnet, I won't," she said daringly, and gave her head a saucy flirt that set the plume to bobbing. His white teeth gleamed under his little mustache.
"Madam, you flatter yourself. I do not want to marry you or anyone else. I'm not a marrying man."
"Indeed," she cried, taken aback and now determined that he should take some liberty. "I don't even intend to kiss you either."
"Then why is your mouth all pursed up in that ridiculous way?"
"Oh!" she cried, as she caught a glimpse of herself and saw that her red lips were indeed in the proper pose for a kiss. "Oh!" she cried again, losing her temper and stamping her foot. "You are the horridest man I have ever seen, and I don't care if I never lay eyes on you again."
"If you really felt that way, you'd stamp on the bonnet." "My, what a passion you are in, and it's quite becoming, as you probably know. Come, Scarlet, stamp on the bonnet to show me what you think of me in my presence."
"Don't you dare touch this bonnet," she said, clutching it by the bow and retreating. He came after her, laughing softly, and took her hands in his.
"Oh, Scarlet, you are so young you wring my heart," he said. "And I shall kiss you, as you seem to expect it." And leaning down carelessly, his mustache just grazed her cheek. "Now, do you feel that you must slap me to preserve the proprieties?"
Her lips mutinous, she looked up into his eyes and saw so much amusement in their dark depths that she burst into laughter. What a tease he was, and how exasperating! If he didn't want to marry her, and didn't even want to kiss her, what did he want? If he wasn't in love with her, why did he call so often and bring her presents?
"That's better," he said. "Scarlet, I'm a bad influence on you, and if you have any sense, you will send me packing, if you can. I'm very hard to get rid of. But I'm bad for you."
"Are you?
Can't you see it? Ever since I met you at the bazaar, your career has been most shocking, and I'm to blame for most of it. Who encouraged you to dance? Who forced you to admit that you thought our glorious cause was neither glorious nor sacred? Who goaded you into admitting that you thought men were fools to die for high-sounding principles? Who has aided you in giving the old ladies plenty to gossip about? Who is getting you out of mourning several years too soon? And who, to end all this, has lured you into accepting a gift which no lady can accept and still remain a lady?"
"You flatter yourself, Captain Butler. I haven't done anything so scandalous.
and I'd have done everything you mentioned without your aid anyway.
I doubt that, he said, and his face was suddenly quiet and somber. You'd still be the broken-hearted widow of Charles Hamilton and famed for your good deeds among the wounded. Eventually, however... But she was not listening, for she was regarding herself pleasedly in the mirror again, thinking she would wear the bonnet to the hospital this very afternoon and take flowers to the convalescent officers. That there was truth in his last words did not occur to her.
She did not see that Rhett had pried open the prison of her widowhood and set her free to queen it over unmarried girls, when her days as a belle should have been long past.
Nor did she see that under his influence she had come a long way from Ellen's teachings. The change had been so gradual. The flouting of one small convention seemed to have no connection with the flouting of another, and none of them any connection with Rhett. She didn't realize that with his encouragement she had disregarded many of the sternest injunctions of her mother concerning the proprieties, forgotten the difficult lessons in being a lady. She only saw that the bonnet was the most becoming she ever had, that it hadn't cost her a penny, and that Rhett must be in love with her, whether he admitted it or not. And she certainly intended to find a way to make him admit it. The next day, Scarlett was standing in front of the mirror with a comb in her hand and her mouth full of hairpins, attempting a new coiffure, which Maybelle, fresh from a visit to her husband in Richmond, had said was the rage at the capital. It was called Cats, Rats, and Mice, and presented many difficulties. The hair was parted in the middle and arranged in three rolls of graduating size on each side of the head, the largest, nearest the part, being the cat. The cat and the rat were easy to fix, but the mice kept slipping out of her hairpins in an exasperating manner. However, she was determined to accomplish it. For Rhett was coming to supper, and he always noticed and commented upon any innovation of dress or hair. As she struggled with her bushy, obstinate locks, perspiration beading her forehead, she heard light running feet in the downstairs hall and knew that Melanie was home from the hospital. As she heard her fly up the stairs two at a time, she paused, hairpin in mid-air, realizing that something must be wrong. For Melanie always moved as decorously as a dowager. She went to the door and threw it open, and Melanie ran in, her face flushed and frightened, looking like a guilty child. There were tears on her cheeks. Her bonnet was hanging on her neck by the ribbons and her hoop swaying violently. She was clutching something in her hand, and the reek of heavy, cheap perfume came into the room with her.
"Oh, Scarlett," she cried, shutting the door and sinking on the bed. "Is Auntie home yet? She isn't? Oh, thank the Lord. Scarlett, I'm so mortified I could die. I nearly swooned, and Scarlett, Uncle Peter is threatening to tell Aunt Pity."
"Tell what?"
"That I was talking to that... to Miss... Mrs..." Melanie fanned her hot face with her handkerchief. "That woman with the red hair named Belle Watling." "Why, Melly!" cried Scarlett, so shocked she could only stare.
Belle Watling was the red-haired woman she had seen on the street the first day she came to Atlanta, and by now she was easily the most notorious woman in town. Many prostitutes had flocked into Atlanta following the soldiers, but Belle stood out above the rest, due to her flaming hair and the gaudy, overly fashionable dresses she wore. She was seldom seen on Peachtree Street, or in any nice neighborhood, but when she did appear, respectable women made haste to cross the street to remove themselves from her vicinity. And Melanie had been talking with her. No wonder Uncle Peter was outraged.
"I shall die if Aunt Pity finds out. You know she'll cry and tell everybody in town, and I'll be disgraced," sobbed Melanie. "And it wasn't my fault. I couldn't run away from her. It would have been so rude. Scarlett, I—" I felt sorry for her. Do you think I'm bad for feeling that way?
But Scarlett was not concerned with the ethics of the matter. Like most innocent and well-bred young women, she had a devouring curiosity about prostitutes.
What did she want? What did she talk like?
Oh, she used awful grammar, but I could see she was trying so hard to be elegant, poor thing. I came out of the hospital, and Uncle Peter and the carriage weren't waiting, so I thought I'd walk home. And when I went by the Emerson's yard, there she was hiding behind the hedge.
Oh, thank heaven the Emersons are in Macon. And she said, "Please, Mrs. Wilkes, do speak a minute with me." I don't know how she knew my name. I knew I ought to run as hard as I could, but, well, Scarlett, she looked so sad and, well, sort of pleading. And she had on a black dress and black bonnet and no paint and really looked decent, but for that red hair.
And before I could answer, she said, "I know I shouldn't speak to you, but I tried to talk to that old peahen, Mrs. Elsing, and she ran me away from the hospital."
"Did she really call her a peahen?"
said Scarlett, pleasedly, and laughed.
"Oh, don't laugh. It isn't funny. It seems that this woman wanted to do something for the hospital. Can you imagine it? She offered to nurse every morning, and, of course, Mrs. Elsing must have nearly died at the idea and ordered her out of the hospital. And then she said, 'I want to do something, too. Ain't I confederate good as you?' And, Scarlett, I was right touched at her wanting to help. You know, she can't be all bad if she wants to help the cause. Do you think I'm bad to feel that way?"
"For heaven's sake, Millie, who cares if you're bad? What else did she say?"
"She said she'd been watching the ladies go by the hospital and thought I had a kind face, and so she stopped me. She had some money, and she wanted me to take it and use it for the hospital and not tell a soul where it came from. She said Mrs. Elsing wouldn't let it be used if she knew what kind of money it was." "What kind of money? That's when I thought I'd swoon. And I was so upset and anxious to get away, I just said, 'Oh, yes, indeed, how sweet of you,' or something idiotic, and she smiled and said, 'That's right, Christian, of you,' and shoved this dirty handkerchief into my hand. Ugh, can you smell the perfume?"
Melanie held out a man's handkerchief, soiled and highly perfumed, in which some coins were knotted.
"She was saying thank you and something about bringing me some money every week, and just then Uncle Peter drove up and saw me."
Melly collapsed into tears and laid her head on the pillow.
"And when he saw who was with me, Scarlett, he hollered at me. Nobody has ever hollered at me before in my whole life. And he said, 'You get in this yere carriage this minute.' Of course I did. And all the way home he blessed me out and wouldn't let me explain, and said he was going to tell Aunt Pity. Scarlett, do go down and beg him not to tell her. Perhaps he'll listen to you. It'll kill Auntie if she knows I ever even looked that woman in the face. Will you?"
"Yes, I will. But let's see how much money is in here. It feels heavy."
She untied the knot, and a handful of gold coins rolled out on the bed.
"Scarlett, there's $50 here, and in gold," cried Melanie, awed, as she counted the bright pieces. "Tell me, do you think it's all right to use this kind, well, money made this way for the boys? Don't you think that maybe God will understand that she wanted to help and wouldn't care if it is tainted? When I think of how many things the hospital needs..."
But Scarlett was not listening. She was looking at the dirty handkerchief, and humiliation and fury were filling her. There was a monogram in the corner in which were the initials R.K.B. In her top drawer was a handkerchief just like this, one that Rhett Butler had lent her only yesterday to wrap about the stems of wildflowers they had picked. She had planned to return it to him when he came to supper tonight. So, Rhett consorted with that vile Watling creature and gave her money.
That was where the contribution to the hospital came from, blockade gold. And to think that Rhett would have the gall to look a decent woman in the face after being with that creature. And to think that she could have believed he was in love with her. This proved he couldn't be. Bad women, and all they involved were mysterious and revolting matters to her. She knew that men patronized these women for purposes which no lady should mention, or, if she did mention them, in whispers, and by indirection and euphemism. She had always thought that only common vulgar men visited such women. Before this moment, it had never occurred to her that nice men, that is, men she met at nice homes and with whom she danced, could possibly do such things. It opened up an entirely new field of thought, and one that was horrifying. Perhaps all men did this. It was bad enough that they forced their wives to go through such indecent performances, but to actually seek out low women and pay them for such accommodation? Oh, men were all so vile, and Rhett Butler was the worst of them all. She would take this handkerchief and fling it in his face and show him the door and never, never speak to him again. But no, of course she couldn't do that. She could never, never let him know she even realized that bad women existed, much less that he visited them. A lady could never do that. Oh, she thought in fury, if I just wasn't a lady, what wouldn't I tell that varmint? And crumpling the handkerchief in her hand, she went down the stairs to the kitchen in search of Uncle Peter. As she passed the stove, she shoved the handkerchief into the flames and, with impotent anger, watched it burn. Chapter 14. Hope was rolling high in every southern heart as the summer of 1863 came in. Despite privation and hardships, despite food speculators and kindred scourges, despite death and sickness and suffering which had now left their mark on nearly every family, the South was again saying, "One more victory and the war is over," saying it with even more happy assurance than in the summer before. The Yankees were proving a hard nut to crack, but they were cracking at last. Christmas of 1862 had been a happy one for Atlanta, for the whole South. The Confederacy had scored a smashing victory at Fredericksburg, and the Yankee dead and wounded were counted in the thousands. There was universal rejoicing in that holiday season, rejoicing and thankfulness that the tide was turning. The army in Butternut were now seasoned fighters. Their generals had proven their mettle. And everyone knew that when the campaign reopened in the spring, the Yankees would be crushed for good and all. Spring came, and the fighting recommenced. May came, and the Confederacy won another great victory at Chancellorsville. The South roared with elation. Closer at home, a Union cavalry dash into Georgia had been turned into a Confederate triumph. Folks were still laughing and slapping each other on the back and saying, "Yes, sir. When old Nathan Bedford Forrest gets after them, they better git." Late in April, Colonel Strait, an 1,800 Yankee cavalry, had made a surprise raid into Georgia, aiming at Rome, only a little more than 60 miles north of Atlanta. They had ambitious plans to cut the vitally important railroad between Atlanta and Tennessee and then swing southward into Atlanta to destroy the factories and the war supplies concentrated there in that key city of the Confederacy. It was a bold stroke, and it would have cost the South dearly, except for Forrest. With only one-third as many men, but what men and what riders! He had started after them, engaged them before they even reached Rome, harassed them day and night, and finally captured the entire force.
The news reached Atlanta almost simultaneously with the news of the victory at Chancellorsville, and the town fairly rocked with exultation and with laughter. Chancellorsville might be a more important victory, but the capture of Straits Raiders made the Yankees positively ridiculous.
"No, sir. They better not fool with Old Forest," Atlanta said gleefully, as the story was told over and over.
The tide of the Confederacy's fortune was running strong and full now, sweeping the people jubilantly along in its flood. True, the Yankees under Grant had been besieging Vicksburg since the middle of May. True, the South had suffered a sickening loss when Stonewall Jackson had been fatally wounded at Chancellorsville. True, Georgia had lost one of her bravest and most brilliant sons when General T.R.R. Cobb had been killed at Fredericksburg. But the Yankees just couldn't stand any more defeats like Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville. They'd have to give in. And then this cruel war would be over. The first days of July came, and with them the rumor, later confirmed by dispatches, that Lee was marching into Pennsylvania. Lee in the enemy's territory. Lee forcing battle. This was the last fight of the war. Atlanta was wild with excitement, pleasure, and a hot thirst for vengeance. Now the Yankees would know what it meant to have war carried into their own country. Now they'd know what it meant to have fertile fields stripped, horses and cattle stolen, houses burned, old men and boys dragged off to prison, and women and children turned out to starve. Everyone knew what the Yankees had done in Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia. Even small children could recite with hate and fear the horrors the Yankees had inflicted upon the conquered territory. Already, Atlanta was full of refugees from East Tennessee, and the town had heard first-hand stories from them of what suffering they had gone through. In that section, the Confederate sympathizers were in the minority, and the hand of war fell heavily upon them, as it did on all the border states, neighbor informing against neighbor and brother killing brother. These refugees cried out to see Pennsylvania one solid sheet of flame, and even the gentlest of old ladies wore expressions of grim pleasure. But when the news trickled back that Lee had issued orders that no private property in Pennsylvania should be touched, that looting would be punished by death, and that the army would pay for every article it requisitioned, then it needed all the reverence the general had earned to save his popularity. Not turn the men loose in the rich storehouses of that prosperous state? What was General Lee thinking of? And our boys so hungry and needing shoes and clothes and horses? A hasty note from Darcy Meade to the doctor, the only first-hand information Atlanta received during those first days of July, was passed from hand to hand with mounting indignation. "Pa, could you manage to get me a pair of boots? I've been barefooted for 2 weeks now, and I don't see any prospects of getting another pair. If I didn't have such big feet, I could get them off dead Yankees like the other boys, but I've never yet found a Yankee whose feet were near big as mine. If you can get me some, don't mail them. Somebody would steal them on the way, and I wouldn't blame them. Put Phil on the train and send him up with them. I'll write you soon where we'll be. Right now I don't know, except that we're marching north. We're in Maryland now, and everybody says we're going into Pennsylvania. Pa, I thought that we'd give the Yanks a taste of their own medicine, but the general says no, and personally I don't care to get shot just for the pleasure of burning some Yank's house. Pa, today we march through the grandest cornfields you ever saw. We don't have corn like this down home. Well, I must admit we did a bit of private looting in that corn, for we were all pretty hungry, and what the general don't know won't hurt him. But that green corn didn't do us a bit of good. All the boys have got dysentery anyway, and that corn made it worse. It's easier to walk with a leg wound than with dysentery. Pa, do try to manage some boots for me. I'm a captain now,
and a captain ought to have boots, even if he hasn't got a new uniform or epaulettes.
But the army was in Pennsylvania. That was all that mattered. One more victory and the war would be over, and then Darcy Meade could have all the boots he wanted. And the boys would come marching home, and everybody would be happy again. Mrs. Meade's eyes grew wet as she pictured her soldier son home at last, home to stay. On the 3rd of July, a sudden silence fell on the wires from the north. A silence that lasted till midday of the 4th, when fragmentary and garbled reports began to trickle into headquarters in Atlanta. There had been hard fighting in Pennsylvania, near a little town named Gettysburg. A great battle with all Lee's army massed. The news was uncertain, slow in coming, for the battle had been fought in the enemy's territory, and the reports came first through Maryland, were relayed to Richmond and then to Atlanta. Suspense grew, and the beginnings of dread slowly crawled over the town. Nothing was so bad as not knowing what was happening. Families with sons at the front prayed fervently that their boys were not in Pennsylvania, but those who knew their relatives were in the same regiment with Darcy Meade clamped their teeth and said it was an honor for them to be in the big fight that would lick the Yankees for good and all. In Aunt Pitty's house, the three women looked into one another's eyes with fear they could not conceal. Ashley was in Darcy's regiment. On the 5th came evil tidings. Not from the north, but from the west. Vicksburg had fallen. Fallen after a long and bitter siege. And practically all the Mississippi River from St. Louis to New Orleans was in the hands of the Yankees. The Confederacy had been cut in two. At any other time, the news of this disaster would have brought fear and lamentation to Atlanta. But now they could give little thought to Vicksburg. They were thinking of Lee in Pennsylvania, forcing battle. Vicksburg's loss would be no catastrophe if Lee won in the east. There lay Philadelphia, New York, Washington. Their capture would paralyze the north and more than cancel off the defeat on the Mississippi. The hours dragged by, and the black shadow of calamity brooded over the town, obscuring the hot sun until people looked up startled into the sky as if incredulous that it was clear and blue, instead of murky and heavy, with scudding clouds. Everywhere, women gathered in knots, huddled in groups, on front porches, on sidewalks, even in the middle of the streets, telling each other that no news is good news, trying to comfort each other, trying to present a brave appearance. But hideous rumors that Lee was killed, the battle lost, and enormous casualty lists coming in, fled up and down the quiet streets like darting bats. Though they tried not to believe, whole neighborhoods, swayed by panic, rushed to town, to the newspapers, to headquarters, pleading for news, any news, even bad news. Crowds formed at the depot, hoping for news from incoming trains, at the telegraph office, in front of the harried headquarters, before the locked doors of the newspapers. They were oddly still crowds, crowds that quietly grew larger and larger. There was no talking. Occasionally an old man's treble voice begged for news, and instead of inciting the crowd to babbling, it only intensified the hush, as they heard the oft-repeated, "Nothing on the wires yet from the north except that there's been fighting." The fringe of women on foot and in carriages grew greater and greater, and the heat of close-packed bodies and dust rising from restless feet were suffocating. The women did not speak, but their pale, set faces pleaded with a mute eloquence that was louder than wailing. There was hardly a house in the town that had not sent away a son, a brother, a father, a lover, a husband, to this battle. They all waited to hear the news that death had come to their homes. They expected death,
They did not expect defeat. That thought they dismissed. Their men might be dying, even now, on the sun-parched grass of the Pennsylvania hills. Even now the southern ranks might be falling like grain before a hailstorm. But the cause for which they fought could never fall. They might be dying in thousands, but